Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Charles Lane, and he will be speaking on St. Helens Remembered. So let's listen in on Charles Lane.
Are there any vestiges left of the old lake? I mean, is that the lake that's there now, except at a different level, or what? Oh, this one.
This lake, you're talking about Chelan.
Yeah. No, I mean Spirit Lake.
Spirit Lake. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, Spirit Lake is there. Again, the bottom of the lake now is about 150 feet higher than the top of the old Spirit Lake.
Oh.
The mud flow has come down off of St. Helens with that May eruption. And basically, the blast blew all the water out of the lake, and then the mud flows came in and just filled it up. Of course, it was this nice bowl-shaped depression in the first place. And so it still was kind of the low spot in the area, and the new Spirit Lake has formed in on top of it. But I'm thinking that the bottom of the lake is about 150 feet above the top of the old one. The top of the new lake is about 300 feet. In other words, the lake's about 150 feet deep at its deepest point. So the surface of the lake's about 300 feet higher than what it used to be. And that's why you hear people talk about poor old Harry Truman being 300 feet down. And most people get buried 6 feet.
He's on the valley door.
He got buried a long ways down. I know the shower. Yes, there is a new Spirit Lake, and there's actually been some interesting work done. The Corps has been in there. They've actually got a tunnel dug through some of the old pyroclastic flow material to act as a spillway down to the Tootle as it's now reestablished. They're a little worried about the lake actually filling up to the point where it overflowed and flooded, so they've actually got some flood control stuff in there. It'll be a long time before it looks anything like the old Spirit Lake. You got all those trees. Hi, Mrs. Rob. You got all those trees in there still. And of course, all those denuded slopes. We were talking about what the new Spirit Lake looks like. Since you're going there all the time, you want to throw in a couple of cents?
I don't think it's located where the same lake was.
Well, not exactly.
But the new lake.
It's shifted positions. So, but it's basically in the same part of the world.
I was there last fall, and we couldn't go down to it yet, but it's open now. Mm-hmm. And there's a boat dock, and there's it's going to be like a park. Right now it looks like a brand new park because there aren't any trees or anything. But
and this, you're accessing this up the Tootle past that Davy Johnson Ridge with that road that was recently opened.
They just opened a new area up there.
It is gorgeous. If you are traveling, it's worth.
I have friends from both from the Mountaineers and from photography.
The thing that surprises me about it is that you drive through all this flat area that's been where it came, and it's brand new highway, and then it's then you come across this lodge, and the architect's done a gorgeous job of making it fit the bareness of the area, and it fits so nicely architecturally, but it just seems amazing to drive and to come into this highly modern museum, unlike the first one you come to, which is all wood. I think you've been to that first one.
Yeah.
Which is very wood and very Northwest. The next one is very rock and very barren.
It's in
the one you go going to the top.
They tried to get something
long
together as quick as they could on that first thing, to show that early devastation.
Yeah, but the contrast of the two, they're both very, very well done, but the one's very gray and rocky. And the view is just,
Sure. Well, let's start this for official purposes now that Keith is here. Why don't we roll the tape? I'm Charles Lane. This is Mount St. Helens Remembered, and that's kind of the basic idea. I have a 30-minute video, not a very long one, and it shows a lot of the footage, and if I'm pronouncing the name right, I think it's the Otto Seaberg party. You guys remember some of those. Those were those three guys that just before the May 18th eruption climbed up there with their video camera and stood on the edge, and you're going to get to see some of that. This is not a high-tech, high-science kind of a video. In fact, it's kind of campy. So feel free to enjoy it as it's being shown. But we'll have a look at this, and then we'll kind of remember. We've got different perspectives that range from Vancouver watching it out your back door to Minnesota watching it on the air quality monitors up on the Canadian border. So this will be kind of a fun session. Let me start the tape.
Times more powerful than the first atom bomb, trips apart a majestic mountain and sends a cloud of dust circling the globe. In minutes, 150 square miles of mountains with all the forests, lakes, rivers, and all their inhabitants died. This film will take you on a journey from the roaring crater's edge to that astonishing instant when the mountain literally came apart, and through the aftermath of nature's incredible fury and raw power. St. Helens, America's Fuji, they called it. But just a child as volcanoes go, only 2,500 years old, and still growing and acting up. Indian legends from time immemorial refer to her as Keeper of the Fire and Fire Mountain, and for good reason. She has been erupting regularly every 100 years or so for the past 700 years.
Geologic evidence indicates that during the last 4,500 years, Mount St. Helens has been the most frequently and violently active volcano in the 48 adjacent states.
The reawakening on March 27th did not surprise scientists.
What we're seeing now is an eruption of steam and other gases bringing up ash, which is pulverized rock from deep within the volcano. These eruptions are being caused by gases from magma beneath the earth rising toward the surface. This is the most active period I've seen the volcano indulge in yet.
The awesome power of volcanoes has fascinated men since the beginning of time. This time, though, they came with the technology to look more closely than ever before. But there's still no substitute for being there on foot. Above the tree line, the scattered dusting of ash grew thicker with each step. Frozen into the snow, the ash looked like hardened, spilled cement and provided good footing. But with a warming sun, it began to melt and form muddy runoffs that made strange, gurgling noises. Running mud on top of steep frozen snow like this quickly made it impossible to climb.
This mud is going to really slow us down, right?
We have to zigzag our way up and try to stay on the clean snow.
The slope got steeper, and each step became more painful. But suddenly the mountain shuddered with a rolling series of quivers that made them stop and hang on. The blast came without sound. Then the roar came. The dark billowing plumes turned red in the setting sun and boiled angrily out of the mountain. They stood horrified by the raw power, but managed to stifle the urge to run. They did, however, quickly agree to go no further and dug in for the night. Because it was supposed to have been a simple climb of 5 or 6 hours, they did not bring anything more than a single sleeping bag for emergency only. The three of them shared that bag and their own body heat on that icy ledge a mile and a half above sea level. The mountain shook a lot, and it was a cold, windy night. No one slept much. With daybreak, their spirits surged, and they lost their fears of the Demon Mountain. The last few hundred feet was smeared with ash, and in the morning cold it remained frozen like concrete and provided excellent footing. The slope flattened somewhat, and they quickened their pace, hoping the summit was close. The ash on top was surprisingly dry and badly cratered by rock and ice. The scene stunned them. It was like suddenly walking onto the moon. Except the thin air and high altitude made them walk like they had lead feet. They hesitated at the mile-long crack just below the summit. The magnitude of force at work here was staggering. Was more than 3 feet deep. But it was gray and without life. While they were worrying about the crack, an eruption began deep inside the crater. It started with a faint drone, and as the plume grew, the sound grew louder too. When they saw the plume rise, they were momentarily panicked, but stifled the urge to turn and run. They'd come too far for that. So they sucked in some air and followed that irresistible impulse to go and peer down into the crater.
Fantastic!
There was a constant crash of falling rock. Coming face to face with the awesome display of power was an instantly humbling encounter. The mountain was crumbling along the entire half-mile wide crater rim and sliding into the throat of the volcano, being thrown back as fine ash. The rumble grew louder. They could make out the sound of rock avalanches. Then it ended as abruptly as it began. And a stillness came upon the mountain. It was an uneasy stillness that screamed at them to get out of there quickly. And they agreed without speaking, it was time to get off the mountain. They left in awed silence. Eruptions continued with increasing frequency and violence, and the curious came from near and far to see one of nature's rarest displays of raw power. St. Helens is in the chain of volcanoes called the Ring of Fire that circles the Pacific Ocean. 80% of the world's volcanoes are located around this ring. The ocean floor, a complex of interlocking rocky slabs or plates, is slowly expanding as new lava rises to the surface through crustal fractures and pushes the plate toward the continents. The plate is forced under the continents where it sinks and is partially remelted into molten rock called magma. Under immense pressure, this molten rock seeks the easiest way up, which is usually under dormant volcanoes where channels or cracks exist from previous eruptions. The tremendous heat of the rising magma creates high-pressure gases and steam. The trapped gases force the north summit to swell into a bulge more than 400 feet high. Flying over the mountain moments before the eruption, geologists Keith and Dorothy Stoffel noted melting glaciers and wet, sweating rocks. Ominous signs of heat were evident in the black, wet areas around the Gope Rock. A reddish debris flow appeared like a dirty wound. Otherwise, everything looked strangely peaceful at 8:30 this Sunday morning, especially the forest below the mountain and Harry's Lodge by Spirit Lake. Then, as they turned for a final pass over the summit, they noticed dust. As they approached, they could see the south face of the crater breaking up and sliding into the hole. Then the massive north side of the summit began to churn and ripple as though the mountain was liquefying in place. Within seconds, the entire north side began to slide down in one gigantic mass. It was 8:32 a.m. The airplane had to dive and turn to escape the blast. On the west side, ham radio operator Ty Kearney saw the blast envelop the north side in seconds. 8 miles due north, graduate student Keith Romholm saw the mountain disintegrate and turn into a cloud of death that churned out of the mountain with hurricane speed. This superheated pyroclastic cloud of shattered rock dust leveled everything in its path for 150 square miles. Deadly gases and sharp-edged silica rock particles with temperatures over 1,000 degrees combined to form a fearsome inferno of death and destruction that rolled out over the surrounding mountains and forests for more than 16 miles. More than 70 people, miles from the mountain, perished without warning.
Finally, the river was choked with logs and debris. 50 miles away, the fury was spent, but the thick, debris-laden mud continued to spread, oozing into homes and backyards.
And last night, about midnight, the water started coming up about 6-8 inches every 15 minutes. And then we were back there in that driveway and watched the wall of mud coming down this driveway all the way up to here.
Entire farms disappeared under the oozing mess. Carried by the wind from the sea, the great plumes of ash that shot up 12 miles into the sky drifted east. The upper layers reached Boston a week later and went on to circle the globe. Like a rolling blanket of fog, the lower layers silently crossed the Cascades. Traffic on the great interstate highways slowed to a crawl. Visibility plunged toward zero in the middle of a sunny day. Accidents mounted, and the clouds of ash kept coming all day long. Spinning wheels churned the accumulated ash into blinding clouds. Finally, all interstate highways were closed from Washington to Montana and Idaho. The air became unbreathable without gas masks. The ash clogged air filters and damaged engines and quickly inspired a flock of outlandish air filters.
Same.
valuable soil nutrients like phosphate and potassium that led to bumper crops. Daybreak, May 19th, revealed the once scenic Upper Toodle River Valley below Spirit Lake in silent agony. Steaming riverbeds and torn, smoking hills bear witness to the hellish devastation. Torrents of mud had scoured the forest valley floor down to bare rock. Giant forests lay like spilled matchsticks. The power of the volcano is etched unforgettably on these hills. This is more than 10 miles from the volcano. Fires were still burning just below Spirit Lake, which had turned into a steaming cauldron heated by debris from the blast. The lake itself was choked with logs ripped loose from the surrounding forest. An unbelievable mat of torn and broken logs almost hid the lake from view. The hot water was still steaming. The trees came from these denuded slopes. Hundreds of acres of giant evergreens vanished from the base of the still smoldering mountain. Looming out of the haze, the hulk of the once majestic mountain shows a gaping hole on the north side, with more than 1,400 feet of its top blown off. The crater is more than 2 miles across, and all of it still hot. Dante-esque steam vents and sulfuric fumes hit a new lava dome nearly 600 feet in diameter. Of the fire. Lingering steam plumes over the mountain came from water dripping into the hot crater. A week later, the ash 15 miles from the mountain was still steaming in the light drizzle. Had to be placed on a human scale. Because it was almost unbelievable, the only way to truly record the effects of this cataclysmic event was to go in and film it on foot. Giant firs were snapped and splintered. Its growth was flattened in seconds. Pyroclastic cloud fell on the forest like a giant sandblaster, stripping the trees of their branches and snapping their trunks. Unlike a blast wave, this cloud was not deflected by the ridges. Instead, it clung to the terrain like a dense fog, bowling over everything in its path. At the end of the first day, the depressing scenery took its toll. Morning, it started to rain. A National Guard helicopter on search and rescue spotted them. Although the pilot urged them to leave with him, he said he had no authority to turn them out of the area. They elected to stay and finish the job. Reels at the fury unleashed on this forest. Even the vegetation on the forest floor was stripped and incinerated. The death cloud spared nothing. It unraveled this metal culvert. This utter destruction was inflicted by the advancing superheated cloud of pulverized rock and gas, traveling at speeds of more than 100 miles per hour. The strain of the trek shortened tempers, and they began to argue with each other. They decided it was time to leave, and they headed for the remains of Highway 504 less than a mile away. Showered with ash from the second great eruption on May 25th.
Charles, this is true.
Half-blinded, they staggered on the next morning. The gooey ash and fallen trees slowed them to a crawl. The death and destruction was so complete that they never saw a single living thing or heard the sound of even a bird. A total and deadly silence ruled the scene. In 10 hours, they made 2 miles.
She kept a secret fire. She loved the river sound.
Surviving in this warped landscape was different. The water was too ashy to drink, and there were no berries or food of any kind to forage. Soaked, exhausted, and freezing, they sheltered under a huge root ball. Even wood for the fire had to be dug out of the deep ash. They didn't know it, but rescue was only a few hours away. It was a primeval and awesome devastation, rendered without malice or mercy. Some survived to tell their story. More than 70 others were not so lucky. Harry Truman's Lodge used to be here.
Down here in the lake, it ain't that old boat. The moon got out when the mountain roared. And the grand old man who took his things, now walking through the mountains of the sacred land. Mother Nature took her toll. She's the one that's in control.
And after the photographers will come the loggers and builders and the planters of trees. And out of the ashes, man will rebuild, even as the mountain rebuilds. Keeper of the fire.
Was the 18th day in the month of May when the mountain started shaking in a serious way? Fujiyama, the wind.
Otto Siever party. Had you not ever seen that?
No. Yes. It's not as bad as you put it.
Well, it's, you got a little different.
I expected it to be a little more hokey. That was pretty good.
That actually wasn't too bad. I really kind of enjoyed some of the folk music that sprung up as a result of all that. Keith, had you ever seen any of that before? I mean, you'd heard the story of the...
Well, the truth is, and what I remember were pictures of the time and people who were trying to get out.
Yes.
But people who
went in,
those stories were kept very quiet. And I think they probably were, it may have been hard to get them credit because I think they really were trying to keep people out. the thing that struck me about it was I remember sitting on top of my car out front of my house watching the eruptions before. And then that Sunday morning getting ready to go to church and finding out something had drastically happened. And then the list of casualties included a fellow named Keith Moore, which is my name. And so I had to try to figure out how to tell everybody
it wasn't in the East.
That that was not me. It was a little hard trying to keep people from having panic attacks before. But that gave you a sort of personal experience, man. Could have been you. As I in Seattle.
Yes, we have Vancouver, I know for sure. We have Seattle. We have a story out of International Falls, as a matter of fact, that we can work on.
That was Tim Oregon.
I wasn't. I just got a little ash on the car. That's about it.
It wasn't too bad. Who else with?
In Pullman, Washington, we got a lot of ash.
Oh, you got a lot of ash.
We send it, yeah.
We got a lot of ash.
We had roughly a half to 1 inch of ash in our yard. And on the roof, especially, I remember getting up on the roof and sweeping off 35 gallons of ash and depositing it. And still, to this day, we can take a shovel full of dirt and down a couple inches, there's this layer of ash that's right. See all the
right. Right. Geologists love that, as a matter of fact, because it's a time marker.
Mm-hmm.
Those violent eruptions are, for geologic purposes, instantaneous events over a wide area, so they're excellent markers of time. They had something like that.
Ben, what were you doing?
I lived in Empire.
So you would have seen some of that.
I don't remember the dust, but the sky got a little bit hazy. You're so far south.
Yeah.
We were on the highway leaving Spokane, and it was right about noon when it happened, as I recall. And the interesting thing was that off in the distance of some miles, there was this horrendous black cloud. It was like a, not shaped like a funnel cloud, but just that black. Couldn't figure out what in the world is that dark. And then another 20 miles down the road, it looked like it was starting to snow on us. And 20 miles after that, it was pitch black, just as black as any night you've ever seen.
You got home safely, though?
At about 5 miles an hour. And we had just had a new air filter put on the car, and so we saved that engine, but one of our other cars we drove a little carelessly the next couple of weeks and then lost an engine for it.
So in this day, I remember we didn't go anywhere without a second air filter, and we all had the masks. Everyone had their own masks that they wore, because I was going to ask you this, Charles. Why did they think it was going to be harmful? I mean, I could never understand it. It seems to me it was Earth. It was coming from the Earth. Why did people say it was going to be harmful? It was Earth. We were taught to be afraid of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, other than just the suffocatingness of it, why was there that thought?
Well, you know, that's actually an interesting question, because you know, again, from the geological perspective, this is part of what happens here. And you know, volcanic soils actually are very fertile soils. I mean, all those nice volcanoes that give you all the Colombian coffee, you know, all that kind of thing. And so it's a little hard to follow. It certainly is hard on 20th century mechanical processes. I mean, it's going to, like say, trash your car by getting into the cylinders. But you know, that's interesting about how afraid everybody was that this is going to have some kind of devastating effect. Certainly, some of the historic eruptions, Krakatau, for example, in Indonesia, and Tambora and the Year Without a Summer, has certainly affected people's lives. If you want to look at it in that perspective, the early 1800s, what, it was 1816 or something like that, was the Year Without a Summer, and Jefferson decided to build down at Monticello, that was his place, and that big immigration from New England states into Pennsylvania. There was actually a big immigration to Pennsylvania in terms of the farmers. They immigrated down there in order to seek a little warmer weather because the winter had been so hard on their crops. And that was Tamboro. That was a volcanic eruption, basically on the other side of the globe, that did that. And so, you know, the really large volcanic eruptions, and Mount St. Helens is not one of them, but the really large eruptions actually have had global consequences. The Krakatoa eruption was kind of interesting because you could hear it basically around the world. And the story is that the British commander on Ascension or St. Helena Island in the middle of the Atlantic beat to quarters because he thought he was under attack. And Krakatoa is in the Indies, not too far from Jakarta, Indonesia. And he thought he was under attack in the middle of the Atlantic, so he had to beat to quarters. So that was a substantial volcanic eruption. But I don't even think that was really the case. I don't think anybody's necessarily all that concerned about long-term climatic changes with St. Helens going.
Part of it may have been, during that same time period, we were just beginning to be conscious of asbestos problems and whatnot, particulate matter of that type. And maybe that association maybe fueled the fire as possible.
It was like the ash itself. We were real supposed to be real cautious.
Right.
You know, what was in it.
It was really hilarious because, to me, at Washington State University closed down the university early and let the kids off without taking their finals. And I was running my veterinary hospital there, and we had to clean it all off of the dog runs and the parking lot and everything. We're out there, you know, wallowing in it. And they're saying, they're letting those students off without taking their finals. It was really
important. Most of them had to drive home, which was terribly dangerous.
Which was more dangerous than staying there to
finish
the term.
It was kind of an interesting way that people respond to an emergency, because some people were absolutely terrified, and then there was, things were just stripped out of the supermarkets. There was hoarding, and you know, you're going, oh, it's just a little volcano.
It's not that close to
it. It's very fascinating to see the way people react.
Any of that in the Vancouver area?
No, because Vancouver had a gorgeous day.
Yeah, they had a nice view. Vancouver would be just not that far as the crow flies from St. Helens, but to the southwest. And so you were sitting on your porch and just watching the show.
Had like you had gone to church, and of course we'd lived with it. You know, maybe what would happen. We came out of church then that morning at the early service, and someone said, well, not St. Helens is blowing. Well, it was such a gorgeous sunny day, you had no, you felt nothing. Then you looked up at the sky, and it was all white. Where we were, it was all beautiful white billows. And people just, we stood and watched it, where there was no earthquake. My in-laws live in Port Angeles, which is what, northeast of Mount St. Helens. They felt the earthquake. And did you in Seattle feel the earthquake?
I didn't feel the earthquake at the time. We saw, you know, we've been watching plumes for days. Uh-huh. They would go up at a certain level and then head east. The only earthquake we felt was driving. We went out later and both looked at it from your view. You could still see some of the building. And we were driving out to the coast, and there was an earthquake, another earthquake, not that one, but because there were continual earthquakes afterwards. And, you know, we were running out, and the road, we kept wondering, is the wind bad, or what's happened to the road here? I come again today, I'm afraid of. But it was just another one of the mountains. But I didn't feel the original earthquake.
Yeah, because
in
Vancouver, it was just, it was a lovely day, and it was like a spectator thing to go out and watch it going. And the funny thing about it was that we had a choir concert scheduled that night, and the name of it was Sing to the Mountains, and we had all these mountain songs, which had absolutely nothing to do with not saying, no, I'm going out, but it just turned out that way. So I thought that was kind of ironic.
Yeah.
But the hardest times for us came with later eruptions that blew into Vancouver and covered everything like you had. And they didn't know how to get rid of it. It was really, you know, it was that was really hard. And And what our neighborhood did, our town did, the fire department would bring the hoses. They started the hoses around. We were all on schedule, and we just kept the hoses hooked up to the fire hydrants. And we swept the street with fire hoses, and then once you had from your fire hydrant in your block to the next one, then that group of neighbors took over. That was kind of the fun part of it, because you had this neighborhood thing going 24 hours where you got rid of the ash. But and then I remember
it right in the storm sewers?
We did. Mm-hmm. We did.
And then they dredged it out later.
I don't know, but we just hosed it. Like I said, on the roof, but where they were afraid of the roofs caving in, and you know, you had to just getting rid of it. You know.
And plugging your gutters and you know, back up and ruin your roof.
But we did go down the sewers with it, and there was never any flooding from it that I remember.
I think part of the hysteria, with all due respect to our news media and correspondents, press and everything, they dwell so on the dramatic, and the bad news sells copy, and et cetera, and here's the evening commentators on TV. Two recent examples, well, not so recent. Here the press was when our troops landed in Somalia and welcomed them all ashore. This O.J. Simpson chase a week ago, I mean, you get all caught up in this sort of thing. Seems to add to the terror of it.
It's a fuel to fire.
Yeah. I think another part of it, though, is that you didn't know what was going to happen and whether that was all there was. Because you might remember, Al Baker had been cooking away for a while before that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was just enough wind changes that, you know, the Olympic Peninsula got a dusting of ash one time, and there was no... A lot of people could feel like they might be potentially impacted, even though the
truth is they really weren't. It's going to blow again and again, but isn't the history of volcanism that once one big eruption goes, there's not going to be a whole series over a period of a month or something? I mean, the top's gone. It can't happen twice right away. It's got to rebuild.
The pressure is off. Yeah. You've got to rebuild it again.
Yeah. We all are believing that. I mean, that is...
You're waiting for Baker to go that way, and so you have to...
I can carry that, man. Give us a window of opportunity.
Yeah. Well, tell me your International Falls story.
Yeah, in our town, for air quality, the paper mills required that had monitors all over town pick up particulate matter that might come out of the mill. But then 11 miles east of town, there's an old fire tower that we bought from the Forest Service and had them monitored up on top of that to give us a background count of what's going on, the pollen count and all that kind of thing. Can't remember exactly, I think it was about 4 or 5 days later, it started peaking out. Mm-hmm. And the highest levels we have ever had since, too. Mm-hmm. And this guy, we did have some pretty sunsets for a couple of days, and you couldn't tell what it was, just a little bit hazier than a strange haze. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that was it, you couldn't see anything.
Our home is 300 miles from the mountain, and the ash there is very light. It's just like spilling a sack of Portland cement and scuffing your foot through it there. But then the closer you got to the mountain, I guess it gets heavier and heavier.
Ellensburg and Yakima were not good places to be.
Sand.
Yeah.
Big coarse sand.
And actually, the top of Mount Rainier wasn't a very good place. They had things in fairly large bombs. Fell on the top of Mount Rainier, it blew out of it.
There are some still photographs taken by hikers on top of Adams who actually had a really nice view of the thing. Well, they were well positioned to watch the show, and since the blast went so much north toward Rainier, they were in no particular danger where they were, and so there are some interesting still photos from Adams, but you're right, Rainier is not exactly a good place to be either. Who else remembers that?
Well, I have a question about material that comes out of volcanoes up on the plateau east of Chelan, around Mansfield, in that area. There are fields that have huge boulders in them that look volcanic. And when you drive through there, you wonder if those blew out of earlier
centuries, volcanoes, or if they were moved there by glacial activity.
I think the vast majority of those things have been moved there by glacial activity.
They're huge. Some of them are three stories.
Those big haystack boulders.
Yeah, and they farm right around them.
And they farm around them. Most of those, to my knowledge, are from what they call glacial erratics, where the glaciers have actually pushed across there.
But they are volcanic
material. I think that most of them in that area are older volcanic material. There are some others that are igneous, but more intrusive. But I'm pretty sure I've seen I haven't seen them. I know where Mansfield is. I've not been over, but I have seen photographs of those things, and those are big volcanic rocks, but glacial erratics.
They look like lava.
Yeah, been pushed there by the glacier.
Well, the huge lava flows in other parts of Washington, many, many feet thick. Mm-hmm. They must have been of an entirely different type than this.
Different type of thing. One of the great fun things that happens to me in some discussions like this is if I start arm-waving about the Snake River Plain or the Columbia River Plateau and all this stuff and start talking about these hundreds of feet thick lavas that cap the plateau and covering hundreds of square miles, you know, one of the questions is, well, where's the volcano? And the answer is that there is none. There is no volcano that's produced that. Those are volcanic rocks because they have come to the surface and spread out as a lava and cooled, so by definition they're extrusive or volcanic rocks. But these are vent eruptions where it's just come up out of a vent in the ground, literally, and then just turn and spread out over the surface of the earth. The place to see that, to see the actual vent, the long line of the vent in a fairly clear, dramatic fashion, is to go to the craters of the moon in Idaho. And you can see it over there very nicely.
Yes.
But that's right. The Snake River Plain and the Columbia Plateau are volcanic rocks, a totally different type of an affair.
Is that because of different composition of the lava? Or a different way, and there wasn't the subduction?
Actually, different composition of lava. This is actually real interesting to the professional geologist because the lava is much more a Hawaiian type of lava. And for it to get through the continental crust without contamination, what happens is when a lava or a magma moves through the continental crust, it becomes contaminated, it melts the rocks it's passing through, and what it does is it picks up more and more silica. And silica, in a lot of ways, is kind of interesting, its relationship to carbon. They're both about the same place on the periodic chart, they both have the same normal valence state, and in the inorganic world, and the organic world, you've got carbon here, you've got silicon here, but they tend to act the same way. And so you talk about carbon hooking to other carbons, to other carbons, to other carbons, to other carbons, to make things like fats, and then that stuff hooks onto the vein walls, you know, in your body, and you know, then you have problems with hardening of the arteries. It's virtually an exact corollary in the inorganic world, because the silica hooks onto the silica, the silica, the silica. And what it does is produces hardening of the arteries with respect to these ascent paths. And so what apparently has happened, you know, we see the effect, we still don't have a good idea as to the cause, but what apparently has happened is all of this more basaltic type magma has managed to get through the crust and up to the top of the earth now without assimilating or mixing in much of the wall rock, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon.
So what makes it possible in earthquakes? Is it an open, sort of like a ridge, or it's not a subduction thing?
No, it tends to be an extensional type of feature. In other words, if you've got something blowing this thing up, well, you can pop the top on this, and they tend to be long linear features, long linear features, pre-existing fault. Trace is a real good candidate for something like that. They tend to be long linear features and they'll well up and kind of spread off, you know, kind of conveyor belt type on either side of that. You can see some of that happening in places where the East African Rift is active. You see some of the same sort of stuff.
So that life put goes on in the ocean.
Well, except that it's a matter of here you've got the stuff coming up above the top of the earth and kind of spreading out. There's nothing really in existence. It just kind of rolls out. To a certain extent, you can think of it like that, like a spreading center in the ocean. Because there you're looking on a much larger scale. And the stuff, what actually tends to happen is the stuff tends to come up and cool without traveling a long ways away. Then the next thing comes up, sort of forces the thing and cools and moves away. So it's not like the lava spreads a long distance subsea. It cools in fairly close proximity, but that's not a bad analogy.
So you mean one's making a plate and the other is spreading over the landscape?
It's spreading over the landscape.
And so the cools, it pushes itself, it's pushing apart further, but it's cold after that.
It's colder after that, yeah. So that's reasonably close. Not exactly the same thing, but reasonably close. Hmm.
What type of the volcano was Pinatubo?
Pinatubo is a composite volcano, much like the Cascade volcanoes. There, what you're looking at is what geologists refer to as an island arc, rather than a continent collection. What you have is younger oceanic crust and older oceanic crust kind of in contact. The real trick to forming one of these big trenches like you've got outside of the Philippines, all you need is a density contrast. Now there's a density contrast between basalt and granite. Granite is much less dense than basalt, as far as a geologist is concerned. But if you have a young basalt, it still has a thermal content. It still has a certain heat content, which of course leads to volume expansion, which leads to lower density. So you get the colder oceanic crust taking a dive under the Philippines, and you get the same type of effect. All the Cascades are what we call a magmatic arc. The Philippines are an island arc. Same kind of thing. That's Pinatubo and the Philippines, all of Japan, those are deadly volcanoes. You see there in Pinatubo has had what are called the New York arms.